The world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II,
a state of war,
to the present day.
Allied air forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles. Thanks for joining us this week for Veterans Chronicles. Our guest is retired Marine Colonel Dave E. Severance, who was in the 10th Wave that went ashore on Iwo Jima on February 19, 1945. Then Captain, Severance went an incredible 36 days on the island without being wounded. He was the commander of the E Company, 28th Marines, the men who raised the flag in Joe Rosenthal's famous photo on Mount Suribachi. This is his story.
I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, on the 4th of February, 1919. As I say, I must have been conceived during World War I, and was always interested in flying. Used to read the pulp magazines we used to get for a dime back in the 20s and 30s. Went to school in Greeley, Colorado. Was brought up in Greeley, Colorado. Went to school there for a year in college. Went to the University of Washington about 1937. During the Depression, it became apparent I would have to stay out of school for a year, so I decided to go ahead and get in the military. I planned to get in the military eventually. I was recruited on the 1st of October, 1938, went to San Diego boot camp, went to sea school, went aboard a carrier, USS Lexington. Lexington was sunk in May of 1942. Fortunately, I got off of it in December 1940. Did a little traveling on it to Hawaii, East Coast. They say, join the Marines, see the world. I saw about half of it. Decided to join the paratroops. Oh, probably about March or April of 1941. I have to keep these dates straight. They're a few years back. I was stationed out at the Marine Corps Air Station, the Marine Corps recruit depot at the time in San Diego. In May, I was out on the parade ground, and I saw an airplane fly over with a paratrooper hanging by his tail, off the tail of the plane, and got a few second thoughts about joining the paratroops. Fortunately, they saved him. A pilot over in North Island, San Diego, came up underneath him in a biplane. The enlisted man in the back seat of the biplane reached up and grabbed Lieutenant Walt Ossipoff. Pilot tipped the nose up, cut the shroud line. Only way they could have ever saved him. Both the Navy people got the Distinguished Flying Cross. I went to paratroops as a corporal. Matter of fact, it's interesting, I've made corporal four times. I never got busted. I made corporal in the National Guard. I joined about when I was about 15. I made corporal in ROTC in college. I made corporal aboard ship, what they called ship's warrant. 6 months later, if you didn't get in trouble, they gave you a permit warrant, so that was my fourth corporal warrant. I was shipped back to San Diego, where we formed a 2nd Parachute Battalion at Camp Elliott, just east of San Diego. About April 1941, before the war, I asked my battalion commander for a recommendation for platoon sergeant, not beat sergeant. Wanted to be platoon sergeant. He told me that I'd have to get a passport photo, and I had to go into San Diego to get that. I remember it cost 35 cents, because that was a lot of money in those days. I was making $56 a month. I brought the photo back to him, and he asked me if I'd rather be a second lieutenant than a platoon sergeant, and I had no choice there. So I went to the first school that they had out at Camp Elliott called Green's Farm. It was a one-month school to produce some second lieutenants, but enlisted non-commissioned officers. So I got commissioned about the 1st of June of 42. Stayed in the same outfit. Had a little problem when we were going through school because we had the OC, little OC pins on our collar. Nobody had seen them at that time. And we found lieutenants and captains saluting us and then reading us off when they got a little close. So we solved that problem by starting saluting at about 40 yards. Eventually, the personnel at the base realized who was there on the weekends. Went overseas with the paratroops in March of 43. We went into Bougainville in December 43, a month after the landings there. I think the next day or 2 days after we got there, they sent us out beyond the what they call the perimeter where the 3rd Division had developed. And we took over the top of a mountain called Hill 1000. There was a ridge line across from us, several hundred feet below us. And the division was interested in knowing whether the Japanese had arrived at that position yet. So they sent me with my platoon down around behind the Hills of Poppin Ridge, it was later known as, to find out if the Japanese arrived. We got about a half mile behind the ridge and we got ambushed. Fortunately, the Japanese were very poor shots. I had two light machine gun squads with me. They were carrying a light machine gun on the tripod on their shoulders. They had 50-round belt in the gun ready to fire. So the ambush was almost like a school solution. We'd been training for this type of thing because we were supposed to operate behind enemy lines. First shot fired by the Japanese, well, I should say the point, out about 30 or 40 yards ahead of the patrol. Spotted a couple of Japanese setting up a Nambu machine gun. They shot them. Apparently that was a signal for the ambush to open up. And they were right beside us in some swamp grass. Their first shot killed my getaway man. It's a man that trails the patrol by about 20 or 30 yards. In case you get hit, he's supposed to turn around and run back and get some help. We had a firefight for about 10 or 15 minutes. Japanese started pulling out. We were able to pick some more off. We got about 16 of them. Had nobody hit except the one man who was killed in the first shot. We'd accomplished our mission. We knew the Japanese were there, and we turned around and returned to base. 4 or 5 days later, they sent a regiment to take over the position. When we got back from the patrol, we found the entire battalion was involved in fighting the Japs on the front of the ridge. But we didn't have a large enough unit to run them out. Anyway, they sent a regiment in for the division, and we conducted patrols until about middle of January 1944. By that time, they decided there was no room for paratroops, there was no place they could drop us in the jungle areas. Pulled us back to the States, disbanded the paratroops, disbanded the Marine Raider units, and put most of us into a new division called the 5th Division, which was located just north of San Diego, Camp Pendleton. I checked in. I made captain about as soon as we landed back in the States. I moved into a tent camp just outside the main, a couple miles from the main base at Camp Pendleton, and took over Company E, which was just forming. The entire division was just forming. At Company E, we trained there until September of 1944, at which time we moved to the Big Island of Hawaii and continued training. I think it was about the middle of November of 1944 that the battalion commander pulled together his staff and the 3 company commanders and briefed us on the upcoming mission going into Iwo Jima.
Back up a little bit before we get to Iwo Jima. You had become a second lieutenant. Where were you when Pearl Harbor happened? You triggered this question because you said you'd just been shipped out to the Big Island of Hawaii, which is obviously looked quite different from what it had in December of 41. Where were you when that happened?
I think I was a corporal at Camp Elliott, having finished parachute training in probably about August of 1941. And then was stationed with the parachute units at Camp Elliott. So I was, I think I was still a corporal when Pearl Harbor was bombed.
What do you recall about hearing that news?
Well, I was in Los Angeles with a buddy of mine who had an aunt and uncle there, and we'd been out on a picnic Sunday, and we didn't have a radio on, and we'd remarked that the newspapers were coming very alarmed. We were seeing headlines saying the United States is going to be at war and so forth. On that particular day, we saw headlines that said, U.S. at war. And as we were riding back to the house from the picnic, they said, well, there you are again. That's another headline. Well, late in the afternoon, somebody turned on the radio. We found out what happened. We were ordered to come right back to the base, but we couldn't because we had 2 other passengers in the car, and they were downtown at the train depot, and we were going to pick them up at midnight, which we did. By that time, we were having trouble getting a clear road going south towards San Diego because of all the defense plants and they put up security around them and closed the roads. We finally drove quite a while to the east and got around the defense plants. We're doing 70, 80 miles an hour. No freeways in those days, it's a highway. Highway patrol pulled us over, and we said, well, we're just trying to get back to the base. He said, go ahead, I'm just trying to clear the road for you. And about 2 or 3 miles further, we picked up speed, another highway patrolman stopped us. And we gave him the same line. He said, the hell with that. He said, if you're going to get killed, don't get killed on my highway. You go get killed by the Japs. So we cruised on into camp. Camp was alive. It was probably about 4 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. People went up. They had their rifles. They were loaded. They had the old tin Kelly caps from World War I, which is the only metal helmets that we had in those days. I think we got 2 hours sleep. The next day we heard a rumor that Japanese paratroopers had landed in San Francisco, so we were prepared to go up and get them. We had the idea that when we were driving back to camp that we'd probably be leaving in a day or two and go to Japan. We thought that's where the war was going to be. I'd say for about a week we spent loading Browning automatic rifle magazines, and then things cooled off and we spent another week unloading them. Then we continued training. I was in the 2nd Battalion. In September, the 2nd Battalion went overseas, and we formed a cadre, and the 3rd Battalion formed another battalion. And we went overseas in March of 1943 to New Caledonia and continued training. Before we left Caledonia, they decided that they weren't going to be able to fly us anywhere. They didn't have enough planes to begin with. So we started rubber boat training. They're going to land us behind the lines somewhere. And it was a little embarrassing when we finally went into Bougainville. It was a month after the 3rd Division had landed there. We went on a, what was it called, a landing ship infantry, I think. Had a couple of ramps came down either side to get off. We had to send a detail back to sweep down the deck. So we didn't figure we were in the midst of the war there. And as I said, we went on out and occupied Hill 1000.
We'll continue our conversation with retired Marine Colonel Dave Severance, commander of the E Company, 28th Marines, ordered to take Mount Suribachi after we return on Veterans Chronicles. You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles with Gene Pell. Joining him is retired Marine Colonel Dave Severance, commander of the E Company, 28th Marines, to continue his remarkable story of battlefield action on Iwo Jima.
So when you found out you were going to Iwo Jima, was it a place you had ever heard of before?
No, in about the middle of November of 44, the battalion commander called his staff and his, as I said, his 3 company commanders in. We had Dog Company, Easy Company, and Fox Company, our 3 infantry companies. And they had a mock-up, a 3-dimension mock-up of the island in the middle of, on a table in the middle of the floor. We saw then what the name, they had a plaque on the side that said Iwo Jima. We didn't know where it was. The briefing continued. We were told why we were going to take the island and how we were going to land. We got a little nervous when we saw the little white flag on the mock-up down on the east beach, easternmost beach, Green Beach, nearest to the volcano. It said the 28th Marine Regiment. That was our regiment. They told us that Iwo Jima was located 700 miles south of Japan and about 700 miles north of Saipan and Tinian, two islands that had the airfields for the B-29, that the B-29s were catching hell from the planes that were located on Iwo Jima. They had to fly by the island because it was 2,800 miles round trip, and that was getting close to the limit of their range. Fly into Japan, then they had to turn around. By that time, the airplanes at Iwo Jima were reloaded, rearmed, and they had to fight them off again. And the Army Air Corps said that the losses were unacceptable. They couldn't continue the bombing. Once we took Iwo Jima, they said they had put long-range fighters in there to accompany the B-29s into Japan. They'd also put an air-sea rescue unit on Iwo. And on the 4th of March, during the battle, the first B-29. They had a mechanical problem. Landed on Iwo, and between that time and the end of the war in the middle of August, they had 2,200 B-29s land on Iwo Jima, 24,000 crew members. So many of them would have gone down at sea, undoubtedly.
Did you have any idea before this battle started what kind of fight you were in for? How fortified it was, or how determined they were, what the numbers were?
No, the only thing that we were worried about was the slope of the volcano. We didn't know whether we could climb it or not. So we did some experimenting with grappling hooks. And we tried first putting a grappling hook on a rifle grenade. Everybody in the regiment, and maybe the division, I don't know, had a toggle rope 6 feet long, had a loop at one end and a piece of doweling the other end, so we could loop them together any length that you wanted for climbing. But we figured if we get a grappling hook quite a ways, then we could hook these ropes on it and get up the mountain. The rifle grenade worked a little bit. It put a grappling hook about 30 feet in the air, but that wasn't far enough. So every unit had somebody who could scrounge material without having to sign for it. We had one of those, went out and got us some aircraft rockets.
Did you meet much resistance on the beach when you went in?
Had a lot of mortar fire. I don't remember much rifle fire. But we had, I guess it would have been a slight lull as we hit the beach. I only had, I think, 5 men wounded, none killed. I had one that almost drowned. We thought he was dead. We left him on the beach. 35 days later, he came back and joined the unit. He had been evacuated. He came to, and he ran, got in another regimental area, a guy by the name of Toscano. And he got pretty close to a mortar shell, got some concussion. They evacuated him. Some Army second lieutenant got a hold of him and gave him a little suitcase to carry. This guy was responsible for surveying in the radar on top of Suribachi. So as soon as we took Suribachi, he and Toscano went up the top and did whatever they do. He kept him with him until, as I say, about 2 days before we left, sent him back. He was listed as possibly killed in action. A funny thing about him, we got back to Hawaii. He came in to see me one day, and he said that he'd been aboard the command ship where General Smith, Holland and Smith, was, and he had asked the general for a photograph. But he came in to see me when I got back to Hawaii. He says, the general never sent me the photograph he promised. I said, Toscano, write to him. Didn't tell him. A couple weeks later, he came in with an 8x10. Dear Private Toscano, I'm sorry you didn't get the first photograph, but I hope this will suffice. General Smith.
How did you rate the Japanese as fighters?
The difference between Bougainville and Iwo was the marksmanship. They could hit anything they were shooting at. I lost all my officers. They sent me one replacement. I took him up to show him where his platoon was located, and he had left some things back in the CP, the company command post. And we were running, jogging back to the... He was on my right. He got out of step, apparently. Some sniper shot between my legs and hit him in the calf. He tumbled down. 20 feet away was a stretcher team. They picked him up, took him back. 15 minutes later, he called me from the battalion aid station. They're evacuating. I don't even remember his name, but he was the only officer replacement I got. I landed with 240 men, 6 other officers, 7 corpsmen. I came out with 44 men, 2 platoons of about 20 each, one led by a PFC, one led by a corporal. I had a staff NCOs, I had a first sergeant and 1 gunnery sergeant. A few of the men joined us back and, recuperated from their wounds and joined us back in Hawaii. But we had between 75 and 80% casualties. It was just a matter of gradual attrition. Every day you lose a few, some days more than others.
We'll continue our conversation with retired Marine Colonel Dave Severance, commander of the E Company, 28th Marines, ordered to take Mount Suribachi, when we return on Veterans Chronicles.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center. an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. This center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012. 703-302-1012. The American Veterans Center, 703-302-1012.
Real political talk.
Who was trying to keep Clarence Thomas off the Supreme Court? Was it the Republicans? I don't think so.
Political talk.
Sarah Palin becomes a grandmother. Is it a matter of me getting older, or is she pretty hot for a grandmother? I mean, you used to think of grannies as, well, grannies. She's a hot granny.
Political talk.
Anytime you've got a good thing going, trust the government to come in and screw it up.
Political talk with Toad.
The Radio America Network.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out. Get
gentlemen,
out.
This is the real thing.
The brutal death march of batons.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the purest space.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles with Gene Pell. Joining him is retired Marine Colonel Dave Severance to continue his remarkable story of battlefield action as the commander of the E Company, 28th Marines, ordered to take Mount Suribachi from the Japanese.
Couldn't see anybody that was shooting at you. Just had to figure where they were, try to get up close. Get a flamethrower in and get explosives, and they were scurrying underground. We didn't have the slightest idea of the tunnels and caves that they had there. The amazing thing is they didn't defend the volcano. They defended the base of it, but not the summit, which was very fortunate. I started to tell you about the grappling hooks. We got some 2.25 or 2.75, I can't remember, rocket motors. They had a cap on the end of them, and we welded a grappling hook to that. Put together some of our toggle ropes and took it out. A couple of boards to make a sort of a chute, fired out of. Worked beautifully. Went up about 100 feet, looped over, and I called the battalion commander and wanted to demonstrate it. So we took it out in the field. We had a little cliff out there about 20 feet high. Lieutenant Colonel Chandler Johnson had a terrible temper, and he also had a great sense of humor, and he had a very thin line between the two. So we set up this grappling hook, and we put a hook probably 100 feet of line under, set it off. We had an overcast of about 1,000 feet. The grappling hook went up beautifully, burned off the rope, continued on up into the overcast, and disappeared. Unfortunately, it was headed right towards the Hawaiian Highway. So I figured I'd had it. I turned around, and Colonel Johnson, he thought it was the funniest thing ever, so he was rolling on the ground. He was laughing so hard. So I said, well, this didn't happen in our demonstration, but we can hook a length of aircraft cable on this, and it'll work just fine. He said, fine, send your crew out and find out where that motor and that grappling hook went. We found it on the other side of the highway. We made up 15 of them. They crated them up and sent them to Iwo. Fortunately, never needed them, and about a month after we got back to Hawaii after the battle, truck drove up, had 15 rocket motors with grappling hooks. Then there was a problem getting rid of them, so I called the same guy. Fortunately, he survived. I said, get rid of them. I don't know where he took them. I don't know where he got them. I don't know where he took them.
Did they leave the summit unoccupied or alone and defended only the base because they didn't think anybody could possibly get to the top or because just made a mistake?
Well, tactically, of course, we always look for the high ground, and they had it. I have to tell you that when we were planning to go in there, It was our opinion if we took the mountain, the battle would end. We figured the rest of the island would fall like dominoes. And, of course, it turned out to be just the opposite. After the first flag went up, we had three Japanese came out of a cave, and we were cut down immediately. But that was the only result. Well, they killed one crawling around looking for water. They figured about 3 days later, 3 nights later. The rest of them scattered and went north. The story comes out from Japan, and I don't know how accurate it is, that I think it was a general or a Navy captain in charge of the defense of the top. I showed up at General Kuribayashi's command post and offered to commit harikiri. And the general said, no, we can't spare any men. Apparently, Kuribayashi expected them to defend the summit, and this guy didn't. None of them survived, so we don't know why.
The second flag that went up was obviously much larger and considerably more visible than the first one, right? And so how far was the vision area? I mean, could the ships offshore see that flag? And what was the reaction when that flag was raised?
Suribachi was around 550 feet high. That's about the height of a 60-story skyscraper. And by the time you got out to the base of it, you were several blocks away from the vertical where the flag was. Apparently, everybody saw the first flag went up. It was only about 4 feet long. All the crowd, all the troops cheered and yelled. The ships offshore blew their horns, whistles, and so forth. Second flag went up. Nobody saw it. You couldn't tell that the two flags were changed. Now, one of the reasons being that from looks of the flag, that the picture that Rosenthal took, you can tell that the wind was coming in from the north. So the two flag poles were about 12 feet apart. I don't know how to describe it. One of them was a little further, the second one was a little further south than the first one. So they almost overlapped, looking at them from a distance, and you're looking at a knife edge of the two flags. So it's something like changing a flag on a skyscraper down here. You know, you pull one up, as the other one comes down, and unless they were looking at it with binoculars, nobody could tell the difference. And the whole flag thing was not important to us. I don't even remember whether I knew they put up the flag or not. I probably did. I did about 2 or 3 days later because I climbed up on the mountain. We didn't think anything about the fact that we put the flag up there.
We certainly never expected that it was going to become one of the real symbols of the war.
I had no idea. Nobody taking it ever said that they knew their picture was being taken. It was difficult to identify them. The only mention in any of the documents, combat reports that I've seen, and I've seen division on doubt, was in the Regimental Intelligence Journal on the 23rd of March. A combat correspondent by the name of Keyes Beach, who was serving with our regiment.
I knew him.
You did?
Yeah.
Well, he was...
Chicago Tribune.
Probably so, yeah. Matter of fact, he went with the survivors on the war bond tour. There is an entry in the Intelligence Journal for Keyes Beach listing the names of five people who were supposed to raise the flag because they could only identify five people in it until they blew up the photo, enlarged it, and then they discovered there was a sixth man there. Well, we were fighting a battle. We weren't interested in a flag somewhere along the way, and I just suspect it may have been around the 20th of March. Maybe somebody got a picture of the flag in the mail. I don't remember anybody mentioned it. Probably around the 20th of March, President Roosevelt was interested in the people that were in the flag picture. And as far as anybody back, although the Marine Corps never said it was the only flag, I think the public figured it was the only flag, and I think the president probably figured it was the only flag, and he wanted the survivors to come back for the war bond tour. And they apparently brought the big flag back at the same time. But by that time, three of the people were dead. John Bradley, the corpsman, had been evacuated about a week before that. Rene Gagnon was identified and was still with us. And Ira Hayes had threatened Gagnon if he told that he was in the picture. when they heard that they were going to take him back for the Waterlogged tour. Ira Hayes didn't want any part of it. So I think that the president, and we can't find any documents of this, I think he sent for the names of the people, and then he decided he wanted them to come back to Washington for the bond tour, because we left there at the 26th of March, and if we had learned any earlier, if we'd learned around the 22nd, 23rd, they probably would have flown Rene Gagnon out of Iwo. As it was, he boarded the ship with us, I don't know, a couple of days later, I guess we went to Eniwetok, landed in Eniwetok, and he got on a plane there and flew back to Washington. By that time, they wanted to know who the sixth man was, and I guess they grilled Rene, and he finally gave up Ira's name. We got back to Hawaii about the 14th of April, and when we got back to our base, our rear echelon, we had a message from the Marine Corps that said no delay orders for Ira Hayes. And I think we put it as probably about the 14th of April and the 16th of April. He was on an airplane headed for Washington. But we still didn't know too much about it. We just still didn't understand all this flag business. We knew there were two flags. We knew that the battalion commander pulled the first flag down because he didn't want the Secretary of the Navy to get it. And from all indications, put the second flag up there to give to the Secretary of the Navy, who had said he wanted it.
So did you see any more combat after that?
Just Korea.
But not in World War II?
No. No, okay. As a matter of fact, we were training to go into Japan in November of that year, and I was training a whole new company. Fortunately, the thing ended. And also another point is that the Anotage and the boxcar, the two atomic bombs, flew right by Iwo Jima. Always a chance that if we hadn't taken Iwo, they could have been shot down, in which case we would probably have been landing in Japan in November.
We've been talking with retired Marine Colonel Dave Severance, commander of the E Company, 28th Marines, the men who raised the flag in Joe Rosenthal's famous photo on Mount Suribachi on Iwo Jima. And now, our weekly World War II Chronicle and a salute to a military hero. Welcome to World War II Chronicles, a weekly tribute to America's fighting men and women in commemoration of the 60th anniversary of the Second World War. These programs are narrated by Ed Herlihy and are based on the news broadcasts of the war period from the recorded sound collection of the National Archives in Washington, D.C.
Corregidor, the fortified island at the entrance to Manila Bay in the Philippines, had been shelled steadily for months by Japanese bombers and guns. Despite the incessant pounding, American defenders, huddled in the rock-hewn tunnels of Corregidor, fought on. The Japanese successfully invaded the island on May 5th and overwhelmed the weakened American forces.
A Japanese landing attack is now in progress on the island of Corregidor, the last remaining American fortress in the Philippines.
The last messages sent out by the radio operator at Corregidor on May 5th, 1942.
Just made broadcast to Manila to arrange meeting for surrender. The white flag is up. I know now how a mouse feels, caught in a trap.
Nothing further has been heard from Corregidor.
Over the Manila radio the other day, a voice spoke in English. The speaker, who coughed and who appeared to be very tired, said he was General Wainwright, and he called upon the other commanders to stop fighting.
Commanding General Jonathan Wainwright was in a hopeless position, commanding a force of only 12,000 men, most of whom were in no condition to fight. He surrendered to the Japanese, who forced him to broadcast an appeal to all remaining American soldiers in the Philippines to lay down their arms.
This is Lieutenant General J.M. Wainwright. Message for General Sharp, commanding the Mindanao and the Visayan forces. Subject, surrender.
On the 10th of May, 1942, General Melvin Sharp, commander of the remaining U.S. combatants in the Philippines, gave the order to surrender. The Japanese had allotted 50 days to conquer the Philippines. It took over 5 months. The delay was instrumental in helping to destroy the Japanese momentum in the Southwest Pacific. I'm Ed Herlihy. Join me next time for World War II Chronicles.
World War II Chronicles was produced by the World War II Veterans Committee and Radio America in cooperation with the National Archives. The World War II Veterans Committee is collecting oral histories in commemoration of the 60th anniversary of the Second World War. For information, call the World War II Veterans Committee Veterans Hotline at 1-800-704-2484. Welcome to Profiles in Valor, stories of decorated men and women serving in today's military. And now from the American Veterans Center, Tim Holbert.
Our guest today is U.S. Army Reserve Sergeant John A. Mara, Jr., recipient of the Bronze Star for actions in Operation Iraqi Freedom. Sergeant Mara, your military career began with the U.S. Army Reserve in 2004. Tell us about your job upon being deployed to Iraq in 2006.
Yes, sir. My job was team sergeant. Our mission as a company was to be a police transitions team, which meant that we worked with the Iraqi police, coaching, mentoring, and running missions with the Iraqis. And I was I had my own crew. I was a team leader.
In Iraq in 2006, when you deployed as well, was a very different place than it is today. Tell us a little bit about your first impressions there and about the Iraqi police. I know since that time they've made a lot of great strides.
Yes, sir. That is an excellent question because, I mean, right now, 2006-2007 is in no way the way that country is operating right now. And I hope that, maybe teams like ours had something to do with that. The Iraqi police is a very unique entity in itself. I mean, there are Iraqis that really care about their country and want to make it a better place. And then there are some that just want to earn some money. And when you put those two together and then mix them with some bad guys, it's very difficult to operate in. There's a big trust issue, and a trust issue not only on our part, but with the Iraqi people and the Iraqi police because of the history of the Iraqi police in that country. We had to learn quickly about how to change that image for them.
I would imagine, and that was around the time too when you started to see a lot of the changes in Iraq. Where were you stationed when you were deployed over in 2006?
Sir, the main city that we operated out of was called Beji. This is a little bit north of Tikrit, which was Saddam's hometown, northern Iraq.
Okay, right. Now, you were there throughout 2006, late 2006, into 2007. And the actions which we'll be talking about today happened on October 24th, 2007. If you could take us through that day.
Our mission for that day was to train our relief. There was a new MP company that came into country from the Washington, D.C. area, and our task was to take them to all of our police stations. And at this point in the training cycle, we were letting them take a little more control of things, a lot more of their bodies than ours. And so this was a very dangerous thing to do. It required us to travel through a lot of hot spots and things like that. So we had to do a lot of planning and rehearsal for this. Luckily so, the things that we rehearsed ended up happening and we had a plan for it. So when the fourth truck was struck by an IED, it was flipped up into the air. We knew that we were going to have casualties. The enemy was attacking us from close proximity, small arms fire. This was something we were familiar with in that area. And my task was to fulfill the role of the medic because we had lost our medic before that. And so I took those duties on and made my way to the truck. I was coming from the second truck all the way back to the fourth one. And myself, Captain Spence, Specialist Van Sickle, Sergeant Riley all began the extraction of the people still inside the vehicle as well as medical treatment.
It sounds like there's some great teamwork, though, not just between the soldiers from the United States Army, but with you and the Iraqi police in getting him out and getting him evacuated.
Absolutely, sir. We could not have done it that day because of the tactical situation. We couldn't have done it because without the Iraqis helping us. We were too engaged in what we were doing because there were still other casualties inside the truck. But Sergeant Blackston had to get to a more advanced treatment like right now or he wouldn't have made it. So the Iraqis were the ones that really helped us get through that. And we gained a lot of respect for them at that point.
I would imagine. It seems like there's a lot of cooperation has really taken root the past few years. So what's next for you? What are you up to now?
Well, sir, I just finished another tour where I was serving as an instructor at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. I was on an unaccompanied tour there mobilizing soldiers that are going to Afghanistan. And so I actually just came off of that tour last Friday, and now I'm trying to get established with my family again.
Sounds like a good plan. Well, U.S. Army Reserve Sergeant John A. Mara, Jr., recipient of the Bronze Star with Valor for actions in Operation Iraqi Freedom, thank you for your service.
Sir, I thank you very much.
Profiles in Valor is produced by the American Veterans Center and Radio America. To hear more profiles, subscribe on iTunes or visit www.americanveteranscenter.org.